This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Friends and family of Fred Adams are gathering today for his funeral in Cedar City. Fred was the founder of the Utah Shakespeare Festival, founder, chief promoter, ringleader, visionary of what has to be one of the most successful artistic enterprises ever in this state, a Shakespeare festival that has thrived, excelled in what was once a declining rural community. Fred is said to have hatched the idea with his girlfriend at a laundromat in 1961. Scott Phillips worked for the festival for nearly 40 years. For part of that time, he was executive director. And Fred's vision was well underway when Scott first met him.
I was in high school, and I had come over to see a production of Fiddler on the Roof. And Little College of Southern Utah back then had the first world amateur performance rights to do it. And he came and spoke to our little high school group about the show, because I didn't know a whole lot about it. You know, being a little kid from a rural community, I just came over to see the show, and I was just mesmerized by his energy, his knowledge, and his storytelling. He was magnificent, and I never forgot that, and it sort of continued to grow as he became bigger in my eyes as I got to know him better.
I remember in elementary school, Fred would come, and this was a time when the festival used to take the costumes around.
Oh, yeah.
To grade schools. And he would make this presentation about the costumes, and the actors would come out in the costumes, and he would explain the costumes, and he would explain the stories. And I think I was taken in maybe in the same kind of way that you were, that he was a master storyteller. People who wouldn't have thought maybe about Shakespeare in the time, I mean, I was, but were absolutely taken by just the way he told a story.
That is exactly right. And I could have been one of those actors, because I was on that costume program for a number of years when I was in college before I went on to work for the Shakespeare Festival. But you're absolutely right. The way he would speak about the history of clothing, the way he entwined it with the facts and then with the historical part of it, he said, this is about clothes and fashion, but it's fascinating because I'm learning history at the same time and being told by this amazing storyteller.
You compared him to P.T. Barnum.
Well, what I meant by that is he never saw anything that wasn't possible. He thought if he dreams big enough and works hard enough, things will happen. And even when he had enormous defeats and things that sort of slapped him down, he got back up and he said, okay, that's not going to work, but maybe this path will work. He was always looking ways to adapt and rethink so his vision could survive in this small rural southwestern Utah town. And he's touched thousands and thousands of lives and made so many of us richer because of that.
What was the vision? What was the vision that he had in his mind way back then for what this thing could be?
You know, it's interesting. He talks about, and it's in the inaugural program of July 1962, he envisioned this campus, which would have theaters amassed on it with rolling hills and babbling brooks, flowers and statuary, a place where artists could come to escape and let their inner selves and muses flow, and audiences could immerse themselves in the words of William Shakespeare. Now, I'm paraphrasing slightly, but that is what he said some 58 years ago on opening night.
Did it seem absurd at the time, do you think?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sure it did. I'm sure there were probably more sheep and cattle in the community than there were people at that time. And they probably thought, what in the heck is this man talking about? But he wasn't deterred. He said, look at our history. Look at our culture. Look at our heritage. Let's celebrate that. Most of these settlers came from England and Scotland and Wales and Ireland. And he said, why don't we relish in that and take these glorious words and put them out there? But yeah, it was a pretty far-fetched idea in his own words, in a phrase he used quite often. the notion of it kind of went over like a pregnant pole vaulter. Those were his words.
Yeah.
Before the festival, give me another sense of what Iron County was like, what Cedar City was like. Say something more about what they made of a man like Fred Adams. I mean, in some ways, he was, you know, he's born in Cedar City. And so he was one of them, sort of, but he also wasn't at all. I mean, he was of another type. They may have seen him in the ward, but he was also an actor. He had this kind of flamboyance that they must have seen as different anyway.
Absolutely. There was a large faction in the community that couldn't quite figure him out. They were enamored by him. They loved him, but they kind of thought, you know, who is that guy over there that wants to create all this nonsense? We're comfortable here in our agricultural community. We've got people coming to the parks by the busloads when they come in by trains. But when he started to come here, all of that was starting to wane. The iron mines were doing well here, but then shortly after, they were closing down. A lot of that boom bust kind of mentality of so many energy related communities. And he said, we can do better than this. Why don't we think outside the box? And then this massive road project called Interstate 15 was just starting in Utah. Part of it was completed certainly on the Wasatch Front, but they were coming down the state. And part of the plans had it going way west of the community. And businessmen and owners were terrified of what it might do. And he said, well, then let's find something to bring the people back into town. And that's how he first started the notion of trying to sell this idea of let's create something that happens at nighttime that will bring these tourists and bring these people into our community. I think people didn't know quite what to take of him. I think they loved him, but they were frightened of him as well.
So he hatches the idea in a laundromat with his wife. He goes to Oregon to get a sense of what Shakespeare festivals are like, comes back. What's the pitch he makes to the town leaders?
Well, the pitch is that, you know, if they can do this in this small rural town in Oregon with a ski resort some 20 miles away, and they have a little railroad system there in Ashland, Oregon at the time, he said, why can't we do it? And he really laid it out and said, look, they've been doing it since about 1935, and it does this and this and this for them. But some of our leaders had a very, very hard time grasping that. They just couldn't wrap their head around it. And he went to organization to organization to organization to try and plead his case. How well he did it, I don't know. I wasn't here, but I can't imagine he didn't lay out a marvelous picture, as we've spoken to his ability to engage people. But it was finally the Lions Club. The Lions Club is the one that said, Fred, do you believe in this? And he said, absolutely I do. He was asking them for $1,000 to help underwrite, not even to give, to underwrite it, to say, I think I can make back every bit of dime I put into it. But in case I don't, would you underwrite it up to $1,000? And they did. And thus it got born.
So the first year's budget, that was it. That was $1,000. That's what they had to work with.
$1,000. It was all volunteers. It was all college kids at the time that he recruited and townspeople. He went to people he knew and said, you know what? Hamlet's a big cast play. We need more actors than we need in Romeo and Juliet or whatever. No, Merchant of Venice. And he said, yeah. So we'll rehearse it at nighttime. So you can still do your work and come in at nighttime. And he had about 3,270 people come that first year, and they made enough money to pay everything off and have a little bit of money to start the following year. So the Lions agreed to underwrite this, but they never had to put out a dime.
So I'm trying to imagine he's doing this at night. He's got kids, young people, older people who are doing their work during the day, some of them working on ranches, some of them working on local farms, some of them have their water turns. And when they have the time in the evening, they come and be part of a Shakespeare play.
And probably some of them had never even read a Shakespeare play, let alone been in one. And he was there trying to interpret for them the meanings and the lines and how to pronounce words. And then they would either go downstairs in the costume shop and work on costumes if they were so inclined, or they would go in the scenic studio of the auditorium building and build scenery and paint sets, because they had to do everything. Mothers would make meals and bring down to them because they were rehearsing three plays a day. They had a morning rehearsal, an afternoon rehearsal, and an evening rehearsal. And in between, they would work on technical stuff. It was really a labor of love to even get it off the ground the first couple of years.
Scott, what do you think Shakespeare, as a writer, as a playwright, what did that teach Fred Adams about the way he went about this? And also the way he interacted with a community of, as you say, ranchers and farmers, this young actor who wanted to put on a show. What did Shakespeare himself, do you think, teach him about the way to interact with those people? And the disappointments and the good parts. Like, what did that teach him, do you think?
I've thought about that a lot over the years, and Fred's tenacity and his ability to sort of carry through. And I think from a very, very early age, Fred was taught Shakespeare by his own mother, and he learned the lessons of how to persevere. Some of the heroes in some of Shakespeare's history plays, of course, the tragedy and disappointment of Romeo and Juliet, because that's one of the first plays he ever read as a young boy. And then his favorite Shakespeare play was A Midsummer Night's Dream. And I think a lot of that idea of the magic of it and suspended belief, I think, helped carry him to say, I believe we can do this. There is magic, and if you provide it to people, they will respond to it. They just need to be given the door, open it for them to accept it. And I know it sounds perhaps easy now, and I know it wasn't, but I know he had that belief about it, and he thought if he could just get them there once to experience the magic of the plays and hear the language, then he would have them either as a patron or a benefactor or a friend. And he never gave up on that because he always said, don't read it. Just let the words waft over you. Let the ideas and the images pour into you and you will understand the play. Don't worry about all of the commas and the these and the thous and the thus. You will understand this message, whether it's love or redemption or jealousy. And then you can figure out how to apply it in your own life and for the struggles you might have had or the joys you might have experienced. And that's what he tried to tell people in all of his orientations year after year after year.
And it worked.
I think it did. I think it did. I mean, people came and they said, I've never understood Shakespeare. I've never enjoyed Shakespeare. But now I get it. And that doesn't mean that they're Shakespeare scholars, and he didn't want them to be. He wanted them to be appreciator of the messages of Shakespeare's plays. He wanted them to understand the power of redemption and the importance of giving back and the importance of forgiveness and love in Winter's Tale. He was a constant teacher. I guess that came from all his university teaching, but he always felt like he had something he wanted people to learn.
How do you measure Fred Adams' effect, his impact on Cedar City, on that region? Because I have to say, this to me seems almost the most powerful part of the story. I think it would be hard to find a place that was so impacted by one person. Like, its economy, its culture.
Yeah.
That seems remarkable to me.
It is true that one person can make the kind of impactful change that he did. Cedar City is a very different city because Fred Adams came here, lived here, and chose to make his mark here. The very essence of us talking about Shakespeare and people having conversations on streets, whether it's about plays or not, it doesn't matter. He changed and elevated the life of everyone who lives here. And he didn't do that intentionally. It was a byproduct. It happened because he just cared so deeply and he wouldn't settle for anything less than what he thought was the best in all of us, whether that was when he was on the planning commission for the city or on the beautification committee or whatever. He said, we can do better than this. And because of that, our city is a different place. And yeah, you can talk about the numbers and the economic impact, but it's so much greater than that. It's an intellectual impact. It's cultural impact that forever changes the way people think about themselves and their families and the lives around them. And he did that here in this not in just the city, but in this region.
Yeah.
Utah's different. Southern Nevada's different because they had the opportunities to experience what he loved so much.
Did anyone ever talk to him about his hairpiece? Did anyone ever speak about that? What was the talk about? Because it seemed amazing, that hairpiece.
There's many of them because as they changed in style and color, so did his toupees. There's more than one time that he would run to an airport and it would start flapping and we'd have to put his hand up there to hold the toupee on so it wouldn't blow off on his way to the jetway. I remember one time he told me that years ago, Cal Rampton was flying down with Lucy Beth for the opening night, and he met them at the airport, and it was a fierce wind, and he went out to shake Lucy Beth's hand, and his hair just slipped right up, almost landed in her face, and he had to apologize to her. So, yeah, the toupee stories are a legend, and, you know, he didn't make any bones about it. He was vain enough to wear one, but not vain enough to let people know he wore a toupee, you know. That's just the dichotomy of the man that he was. That's just who he was.
Yeah. Do you mind if I ask when you last saw him?
The last time I saw him was when he passed. I was one of three people in the room when he passed. His family had been there for hours, and his two daughters were there, and myself, when he actually left us at 3 a.m. on February the 6th. But the last words he spoke to me prior to having to go into surgery, he and I had this, I don't know what you call it, we had kind of a dialogue. We had a companion thing. He called me boss, and I called him boss all the time. What are we doing today, boss? I don't know. What's my chores today, boss? And just before he was wheeled out into surgery, and he unfortunately didn't ever regain consciousness from that, but he just took my hand and he said, "I love you, boss." And those were the final words that I heard from his mouth. So that was the last conversation I had, and it was joyous because it was the thing we had shared together.
You know, Scott, it seems like when you think about that vision he had in mind so many years ago, it seems like it may not have exactly lived up to the babbling brook image that he had, but he got what he envisioned. He got what he wanted, and that seems like a rare thing.
I think you're right. And I've talked to him about that, too, and he said, you know, that was my dream. That was something that I talked about because I'd been to Stratford and I'd been to England. But he said, Scott, we got so much more. You think of the relationships that we've built. You think of the hundreds of thousands of artists that we've had a chance to interact with. You think of the thousands of friends that we've developed and hopefully somehow touched their lives and changed them in a way. He said, I got so much more. It wasn't exactly everything he wanted in the physical sense, but I think in a much greater spiritual and emotional sense, he got way more. And he felt like he got so much more back than he ever put into it. And he was there 18 and 20 hours a day, but didn't matter. He got so much more back.
Scott, you're really generous to take this time. I know this is not easy, but thank you very much for taking the time with us this morning. We're grateful.
It's my honor to have spoken on his behalf. He was my friend, my mentor, my colleague, my compatriot, and my best friend. I loved him.
Scott Phillips. He's the former executive director of the Utah Shakespeare Festival, where he worked for nearly 40 years. Fred Adams, the company's founder, died last week. He was 89 years old. Today, friends and family are meeting for his funeral. His family has asked that people wear something glitzy in Fred's honor. Radio West is a production of KUER. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Tim Slover, and Ali Vallarta. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.